That was great. Thank you. What I wanted to start this morning with is I thought we'd begin with a bit of civil rights history, a bit of a quiz. So what I'd like to do is see how well you know your civil rights leader, shall we? So I have a person in mind, and I want to tell you a bit about what they did to see if you can piece together who this person is, okay? So this person in 1964 founded his own law firm and took on some of the most notable civil rights cases in Kansas during the late 60s and early 70s. In fact, it is said that one-third of all civil rights cases that came to trial in Kansas were handled by this person's law firm. This person would go on record to say this, that they systematically brought down Jim Crow laws in Kansas, and this individual would pay a heavy price for it, including this person was shot at while they were driving, their car and home was vandalized. This person handled some of the most high-profile civil rights cases of his day. He took on the Kansas State school system for racial discrimination. He took on the Kansas police for racially charged abuse of blacks. He took on Kansas Hydro for racial discrimination. Kansas telephone companies for racial discrimination. Kansas City Attorney's Office he took on for racial discrimination. And he took on two Kansas universities for racial discrimination there as well. I mean, this person really handled and won some of the biggest civil rights cases in Kansas. And not only that, this person ended up running for the Democratic Party five times during the 1990s. He never won, but he was a staunch supporter of the Democrats. Anyone have a clue who I'm talking about? Oh, this works so well. I was worried someone would know. Here's who I'm talking about. Next slide. Fred Phelps. Right? That Fred Phelps. The Fred Phelps of Westboro Baptist Church. Oh, my goodness. Now, what I just told you about Fred Phelps is not the Fred Phelps we know at all, is it? The Fred Phelps of Westboro Baptist Church needs no introduction, which I don't know about you, but this leaves me completely mystified. Did this blow anyone else's mind? What? That's crazy. And it leads to a very disturbing question for me. How does one man go from starting a church and a legal firm that aggressively defends civil rights to a man behind the church that hates everyone? Everyone. What shifted? What happened? When Fred Phelps died in 2014, Westboro Baptist Church claimed that they had picketed more than 53,000 events. From Lady Gaga concerts, funerals of soldiers, celebrities, LGBTQ community, they pronounced God's judgment and hate at the site of natural disasters, and even school shootings. They went to Sandy Hook and picketed and protested there. Now, in the name of research, I got to tell you, I went to their website this week. That's something. Wow, it would be comical if it wasn't so terribly scary and sad. On their website, they have all these numbers listed. How many people are burning in hell right now? How many people they've picketed? They've got all these numbers on the side, and right at the bottom, it made me kind of chuckle. They have this big zero, and underneath it, it says, zero, the amount of nanoseconds any of us worry about what the rest of you think of us. And then they have a whole site on their website where they do cover songs, all the greatest hits of today, like the Billboard 20. They cover them and basically change the lyrics to say, God hates you. So they're covering Lady Gaga. They're covering Beyonce. It's, don't go there. It's a weird, it's like a vortex of weirdness you get down into. It's, wow. Oh, Westboro is relentless in their hate-filled approach. Show up at event after event. I'm sure you've all seen it on the news. You all seen. They show up with a handful of their members. Oftentimes, they come with small children, and they're carrying signs. God hates basically everyone. God is your enemy. Westboro Baptist has dominated the news for the past decade with their message of hate. And my mind is blown. What in the world happened? There's got to be some sort of story here. What happened to Fred Phelps? How do you go from this staunch supporter of civil rights to this severe and unrelenting hate? And the truth is this. For Fred Phelps, I have no idea what happened. I'm sure if I researched it more, I could figure out, but I'm not sure I want to go down that black hole of trying to figure out what happened to him. But something disturbing happened to Fred Phelps and his church. I would say he came under the influence of something sinister and strange. And what happens is this. Is this whole, they're an extreme case, obviously, but it leads to a very important question for me, and it's this. What happens when religion or ideology becomes demonic? Beyond that, how does religion become demonic? How does that happen? Over the past 3 weeks here at Nexus, we've been essentially talking about evil and how we resist it, and we've been talking about this ancient idea of spiritual warfare, which, let's be honest, this is not exactly a popular concept today. It's not something that you hear a lot about. Spiritual warfare and the apparent superstitions that surround it are not exactly in vogue. And probably for good reason. I mean, one of the main concerns I think many of us today have with this whole idea of spiritual warfare is that anytime you start talking about angels and demons, light and dark, battles between good and evil, Jesus and Satan, this dualistic vision can really lead to harm. And Fred and his church, Westboro, they're an extreme example. But when you have a dualistic vision of the world, good and bad, there are times this can lead to really harmful consequences. Because here's the reality. There's no question in my mind that Fred, Westboro Baptist Church, they believe they are forces of light and good fighting evil. And it's so perverted. And the worry, I think, for many of us is as soon as you start getting into this, we're battling things, it can lead to Fred Phelps and Westboro Baptist Church. And if we're going to talk about evil and demonic forces, we have to take a sort of a good, hard look in the mirror, I think, and ask yourselves how the Christian faith can take such a dark turn. Where did something go really wrong? How does religion and faith end up creating a Westboro Baptist Church? Because Westboro's essentially turned God into a weapon that they employ against other people. So what happens when religion goes wrong, very wrong? Well, I have a theory, and it comes down to a mathematical equation and whether your answer to the equation ends up being one or two. But to answer that question, we first have to talk about national anthems. I'm disconcerted. One of the very first things, not very first thing, the first thing that Zoe learned in school was the national anthem. It cracked me up because she'd be home trying to sing it and it was awful. But I'm like, this is a fascinating thing to me. I don't know about you, but I just find the whole national anthem thing bizarre. Go to a sports game, you got to stand, you got to take off your hat, and you go through the motions. It's like, this is just so odd. And the very first thing our kids learn in school is the national anthem. Why is that? Seems bizarre to me. National anthems are loaded with an idea of identity. They're loaded with politics. I mean, consider the amount of fuss that national anthems create. I think it was last year's Super Bowl. Was it the Canadian Tenors? And one of the tenors went rogue, right? Singing the national anthem and started singing about All Lives Matter. And people are like, wah. Crazy, because on one end it was like, you don't mess with the words on the one hand. And then on the other hand, it was like, okay, you did mess with the words, but you made a really loaded political statement by saying All Lives Matter instead of Black Lives Matter. And so the tenors like kicked him out. And it's like, oh my goodness, this is crazy. Or this whole year, right? Colin Kaepernick, the whole story we've been hearing this whole year in football is he won't stand for the national anthem. Why? Because it's a political protest. It's a way of resisting. And so we sort of think about national anthems as, oh, whatever, who cares? But it seems like it's loaded. We teach our kids them. It gives them a form of national identity. It's the thing that causes us, you know, when the U.S. and Canada play hockey, we're, don't like the states, right? We've got this nationalistic pride in us. And it becomes loaded over the years with so much politics involved in it because it's about identity. It's about finding an identity. And so into this sort of quagmire of national anthems, if you travel back with me to ancient Israel, you will find that while Israel didn't have necessarily a national anthem per se, they did have something they recited every single day, and it was called the Shema. What is the Shema? Well, the Shema was and is the cornerstone of the Jewish faith. It's what gave them and still gives them their sense of an identity. And like a national anthem, it helped define who they were as a people. And so you have to remember, in a world of polytheistic religion, in a world that believed and worshiped many gods, what made Israel distinct was its belief in one God. And so every single day, Jewish people would recite the Shema, which you can find in Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 5. It says this, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength." And so every day the Israelites would recite this fundamental creed of their faith and identity. Be like them for kids going to school today. First thing, classes start, what's the first thing they do? Listen to national anthem, because over time it's boom, it's forming your identity. Identity over and over again. But where things got really interesting is this formed their identity and their purpose. Okay, so we're about one God and we love this God a lot. But what does that entail? How do you practice that? And this is where things get so interesting for me, because like any faith question, the real fun is in the question of interpretation. And this, for the rabbis at Jesus' time, was one of the fun, interesting questions that you would dialogue, debate about. And so Jesus, a rabbi himself, he sort of speaks into this question. What does it look like to practice the Shema? So here's what happens in Matthew 22. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, okay, so he had got the better of them, the Pharisees got together. What can we do? Okay. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question. "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Now, this is a trap because the question should be easy. What they're trying to find out is if Jesus is going to dabble a little further, go unorthodox here. This is an easy, easy question. Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment." Now, so far, very predictable. He's answered with the Shema. He's pointing to the national anthem. But Jesus isn't done. Continues and says this. "The second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." So what Jesus has done is taken the Shema, Deuteronomy 6, and then he takes a rather random law from Leviticus. If you read through Leviticus, congratulations if you can make it through. But it's basically a whole bunch of laws, single laws. And Jesus takes this rather abstract, sort of bizarre single law from Leviticus 19 and plops it in alongside. What Jesus has done is amended the most important doctrine in the Jewish faith. He's sort of changed the lyrics just a little bit. Somehow, Jesus is saying that loving God seems to be related to loving people. Now, all of this seems simple enough, right? Many of us here have heard this commandment, love God, love others. We've heard it our whole life. I don't know any church, possibly with the exception of Westboro, that doesn't have some form of this in their vision, mission, whatever you want to call it. We're about loving God, loving others. And so, this is pretty predictable to us. But what happens is how this plays out, I think, is where things can start to go wrong, very wrong. How do you balance those two commands, love God, love others? It brings us back to our math question. Is the answer one or two? What exactly is Jesus saying here? Is Jesus saying that we should have one love or two loves? Is there one love that we direct at God and another love that we direct at people? And most importantly, if there are two loves being talked about here, maybe there are times when these loves could come into conflict with one another. Like maybe there are times when in loyalty and allegiance and love to God, that might mean that our love for others might need to be minimalized. And so if your answer is two, that there's two loves Jesus is talking about here, we have to admit there could be times, there could be occasions when our loyalty and love for God would need to trump our love for fellow human beings. Most of us probably understand this instinctively in our life. Like for instance, I actually have two loves in my life. Like I could say to you, I love all children. Now, you would know that's a bold-faced lie. I don't love all children. But theoretically, I love all children. But there are occasions, right, when my own love for my own children will trump the love I have for other children. So listen, if it came down to it, and I could only feed my kids or your kids, I'm going to feed my kids, right? The two loves would come into conflict there. And this is the same here. In the two love view, Jesus' command here, there's a love for God and a love for humans, and occasionally, there could be times when love for God must trump love for people, neighbor. Think right now about the person you love most, friend, partner, parent, whoever it is. Now, if you can imagine in your head right now, is there ever a time in showing love to that person, it might require you to harm someone else? If you can imagine that, and I can, then you'll know exactly what's going on here with the two views. If in your love for your friend, your partner, your parent, your children, whoever, if you can imagine in your head, my love for this person could, under the wrong or right circumstances, mean I have to harm this person. If you can imagine a scenario like that, you'll know what's going on. Two loves, they can come into conflict with one another. And this is where trouble really starts brewing. Fred Phelps and Westboro Baptist Church, they're an example of the extreme outcome of this, of two loves, because in their mind and their misguided love for God, they believe, okay, to demonstrate our love for God, it's going to mean that we need to be mean and harmful to people, right? This is precisely how love of God comes to justify hatred towards human beings. And this is the thing. If you ever hear someone in your life say that they love God more than they love people, look out. Because they are primed to hurt someone. This is the danger of the two-love view. If there are two loves, there's a possibility that that can come into conflict with my love for people. And when that happens, love of God can be used to justify hurting people. And it can be done in very, very, very small ways, or it can be amped up all the way to Westboro Baptist Church. And here's the thing. This is where my atheist friends and people skeptical of faith, this is where they love to chime in. It's so predictable. See, religion is the root of all violence and harm, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I get so tired of it. Are you kidding me? The problems in our world are way more complex than that. Than just love of God trumping love for other people. Problem has always been this. Love of anything, ideology or politics, anytime that trumps love for other people, we're going to have problems. Take some easy examples. Think about the United States right now. So easy, I know, easy picking, low-hanging fruit here. But think, Murray and I went down to the States to a conference one time, and we're sitting in the conference, and we're telling them that neither of us have, like, ever touched a gun. Like, we don't own a gun, never touched a gun. And, like, their minds were blown. What? That's crazy. And here's the rhetoric that I hear in the States a lot. We love the Constitution. The Constitution is, man, we love the Constitution. It's like, and it's weird, because Christians down there, it's like, Bible, I don't know, Constitution, Bible. And this is the problem. When you love the Constitution more than people, what ends up happening is you will defend the idea that we have the right to bear arms, even if it means other people get hurt. Love the Constitution. Love the ideas in it. That might mean people get hurt. Well, that's the price we're going to have to pay. Or use of torture. Oh, my goodness. The fact that this is even being talked about again is just disgusting. And what's the idea there? When love of national security and safety trumps love other human beings. We love our safety. We want to make sure we never get attacked again. That could mean you hurt some people. Well, it's the price you pay for loving an idea. Or banning refugees. When love of safety and security, when that idea that we deserve to be constantly safe and secure, when you love that idea enough, it will justify ignoring the plight of other people. Or silencing those we disagree with. Have you heard of this guy, Milo Yiannopoulos?
Fascinating character.
But again, it is such a polarized state we live in today. He was giving a speech at Berkeley in the States, and it was shut down because people loving their idea that people should remain safe saw fit to start a riot and physically harm the people who disagreed with them. So in our love for the idea, all people should be safe, what about the people who don't believe that? Well, then it might be okay to harm them. Or so many of us are in love with the idea of capitalism. When the market is open and competitive, it makes us better as human beings. It leads to a better society. What if that means that some people are marginalized and exploited? Love capitalism. That's just the price we have to pay. Works the other way. Socialism. Socialism, right, by definition, the good of a society as a whole is collectively defined, and then representatives are given powers to implement it. And those powers then suppress the rights and aspirations of individuals who are perceived as not going along with the collective idea of a good society. And what happened in the Soviet Union? Private property was seen as not in the interest of the collective good. And what happened? Ship them off to the gulag, forced labor camps. Love the idea of socialism. What if that means we have to harden people? Well, I love the idea. Somebody might have to get harmed. It's so much easier to pick on religion, though, right? So back to religion. But next time somebody says, seriously, religion is the root of it, be like, come on, you're not dealing with a dummy here. Ideology, love of any idea, can start to harm people. And we see here, when Jesus' words here are seen as two loves, love for God, love for people, there will be times when we feel like love of God must trump our love for people. And when that happens, small hurts all the way to Westboro Baptist Church. So I'd say this morning, this is why I believe the view that Jesus is talking about two distinct kind of loves, I think we need to reject that as bad hermeneutics, an interpretive mistake. Because once you admit the possibility, a Pandora's box is open. All it takes is someone like Fred Phelps to say, aha, we must be loyal and love God, and that's going to mean hurting other people. All it takes is someone like that, and you've got some big problems on your hand. But in the opposite corner, what you have is Jesus sort of stating, no, what I've done is interpret the Shema. There's only one love at work in the greatest commandments, and what Jesus is doing by quoting Leviticus 19:18, he's not creating a second category, he's specifying, this is what love of God looks like. This is what love of God consists of. He takes Leviticus 19 and interprets through that Deuteronomy 6. And in my mind, it makes one point. Loving human beings is loving God, and loving God is loving human beings. There's only one love at work. Consider 1 John 4. Whoever claims to love God yet hates a brother or sister is a liar. For whoever does not love their brother and sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. And he has given us this command. Anyone who loves God must also love their brother and sister. Loving our neighbors, loving others is the complete and full expression of what it means to love God. I mean, listen to what Paul says in Romans 13. Let no doubt debt remain outstanding except the continuing doubt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be are summed up in this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Not two loves, one love. Religion and ideology and politics become demonic in my mind when they are used to hurt people. When we love the idea, the faith, the religion, the politics more than the people it's designed to help. And here's the thing. If we get this one thing wrong, then everything starts to go wrong with it. And so in my mind, in the one love view, I don't throw the heresy word around much here, but I think it's an act of heresy to claim or act upon the idea that you could possibly hurt another human being in the name of a loving God. In the name of pleasing God or obeying God, there's no way that can be squared with hurting or harming another human. There's this story in Scripture. I love it. Jesus is on his way to his cross. He's resolute about it. And Peter doesn't like this idea. So he tries to stop Jesus. And Jesus has like the biggest throwdown ever, right? What does he say to Peter? He says, "Get behind me, Satan." Man, that seems harsh. It's an interesting story on a number of levels, though, because Peter is the leader of the disciples. Peter ends up being the leader of the church, first leader of the church. Peter is essentially all of us. And Satan, you will remember, means opponent, adversary, accuser. To be a Satan means to be against something. What was Peter opposing? Peter was trying to stop the cross from happening, and the cross was Jesus' full expression of self-sacrificial love. And in that, Jesus sees Peter trying to stop him from being loving to others and says, "You've become demonic. You've become the Satan. You need to get behind me." And this is always the way. Churches, faith, politics, ideology, all of them are, of course, well-intentioned. But when they forsake the self-giving love of others, they become the Satan of Jesus' way. And any faith, church, idea, or group that calls us away from self-giving love becomes demonic. And here's the thing. Personally, I've come to expect that of politics and power and ideology. But Jesus says to his own disciples, to the church, that's not the way with you. Religion becomes demonic when it forgets the call to self-sacrificial love. Churches become demonic when they believe love of God could ever mean not loving or hurting someone else. And every follower of Jesus, every church will ultimately face the same decision Peter did. Choice is between Satan and the way of the cross. That's the fork in the road. And it will happen to us countless times during the week. It will happen to us countless times in community. When our idea, we're convinced we're right, if that ever allows us to do harm to someone else, we've crossed the line. Or in churches like this, if we ever got really passionate about something, convinced this is the right thing to do, if that ever crosses into hurting, harming someone else, we've chosen the wrong path. And so my hope is this. May we here at Nexus find ourselves under the influence of God's Spirit and always find the fortitude to follow the way of the cross. Resist the devil's temptation to turn love into harm. So, one love. I'm going to ask the band to come and sort of give us a way to respond. And I love this song, "Lord Have Mercy," because I don't know about you, but throughout my week, I'm constantly faced with this. And how many times, Ruthie alluded to it, how many times I fail to follow the way of the cross as opposed to another sort of way, a way of harm. So, but before they play, maybe if we have time for questions, I don't know if we do. Forgot my watch again. What time is it there?